KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. House Republicans narrowly passed a budget that cuts taxes, cuts Medicare spending, and adds to the debt. Now senators decide how much of that bill they'd like to keep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Some Americans struggle with new guidance on COVID shots. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Stephen Skeep. The Trump administration dropped a recommendation for pregnant women and children if they're healthy. What does that mean for people who still want the shots? Also, what does a concert pianist do if the thought of performing causes panic attacks? It's Monday, June 2nd. This day in 1886, President Grover Cleveland married while in office. He was 49. Frances Folsom was 21. He'd been a friend of her late father, and she became the youngest first lady. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Representatives from Ukraine and Russia have held a second round of peace talks in Istanbul, Turkey today. These lasted for only an hour. This comes as Ukraine's security service says it will continue to strike Russia's bombers and other military targets as long as Russian attacks continue on Ukraine. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv. Ukraine claims it hit more than 40 Russian warplanes deep in Russian territory.
In a statement, the head of Ukraine's security service, Lieutenant General Vasyl Malyuk, said Russia uses these planes to bomb Ukraine nearly every night. He wrote on social media, "Our strikes will continue as long as Russia terrorizes Ukrainians with missiles and Shahed drones." In this weekend's operation, officially dubbed Spiderweb, Malyuk explained that it was a task that took more than 18 months to plan. It involved hiding drones inside the roofs of wooden cabins placed on trucks. Malyuk said the roofs were opened remotely and the drones flew out to hit the Russian bombers. Russia acknowledges the bombers were hit, but is disputing the scale. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
An official with the Department of Homeland Security has issued a statement about the suspect in yesterday's attack on a group of peaceful marchers in Boulder, Colorado. The official says the suspect came to the U.S. on a visa that expired more than 2 years ago and that he had earlier applied for asylum. Officials say the suspect threw incendiary devices into a group of people in Boulder yesterday. Alex Asante was an eyewitness.
One of them he threw inside of a group, at the group, and one lady lit on fire from head to toe. And then the other four people were also injured and in a fire, but not as bad as the first one.
The marchers had been gathering weekly in Boulder to highlight the plight of Israeli citizens held in Gaza. Authorities say they're investigating the attack as an act of terrorism. The city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, is raising money for a $105 million charitable trust. Organizers say they'll use the donations to repair harm from the Tulsa race massacre. From member station KWGS, Max Bryan has more.
As many as 300 people were killed and dozens of homes and businesses leveled in the 1921 Tulsa race massacre when a white mob razed the city's prosperous black neighborhood of Greenwood. Tulsa Mayor Monroe Nichols announced the trust, which will put millions of dollars toward housing, reducing blight, land acquisition for descendants, and spurring economic growth.
There is not one Tulsan, no matter of their skin color, who wouldn't be better off today had the massacre not happened.
The mayor's announcement follows city officials' creation of a commission to explore reparations for descendants of massacre survivors and people who live in the area today. For NPR News, I'm Max Bryan in Tulsa.
You're listening to NPR. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to hear a challenge involving guns. The justices turned away a challenge to a Maryland law that bans assault-style weapons. The law was passed more than a decade ago after the mass shooting in a classroom of children and educators at Sandy Hook Elementary. Other states have similar measures. The court's majority did not offer a reason why it did not take the case, but three justices said they disagreed. A fourth justice said such bans are probably unconstitutional. Groundwater reserves in the western U.S. are rapidly drying up. From member station KUNC, Alex Hager reports, scientists used NASA satellites to gather data for a new study.
The numbers they found are grim. Over the past two decades, the Colorado River Basin lost nearly 28 million acre-feet of groundwater. That's roughly the amount stored in Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir. Kathleen Ferris is a groundwater expert at Arizona State University. She wasn't involved in the study, but says groundwater pumping needs better regulation.
We need to do far more than we're doing. And I am very pessimistic that the political will to make something happen is not there.
Ferris said stricter rules are needed soon because of the shrinking Colorado River. More cities, businesses, and farms are pumping groundwater as the amount on the surface gets smaller. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Fort Collins, Colorado.
The National Weather Service has issued air quality alerts for nearly all of Minnesota. That's due to Canadian wildfires. The wildfires have forced more than 25,000 people to evacuate. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Coming up, the Atlantic hurricane season is here. Forecasters want people to be prepared even if they do not live near the coast.
First, though, the GOP-led Senate returns from recess today to move a multi-trillion dollar budget plan that carries the bulk of President Trump's domestic policy agenda.
Senators have been sent a House-passed plan that Democrats criticize and that some Republicans doubt. It extends tax cuts and adds some new tax cuts. It makes big changes to defense, energy, and immigration policy. It cuts some spending, although overall it calls for even more borrowing than would otherwise be the case.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales is here to tell us all about it. Just one vote, Claudia, just passed by one vote in the Republican-led House. What do we expect in the Senate?
That's right, A. And we just expect a lot more of the same, but just multiply the intensity as Republicans in the Senate have a very different balancing act than the House. And Senate Republicans can only lose three votes to get this across the finish line. We're hearing some already raising concerns about provisions in this bill. And the upper chamber also faces tougher procedural hurdles that could shape the final version of this plan. So we expect some pretty tough negotiations to get this done by their July 4th deadline, which, by the way, is driven in part by the bill's provision to lift the federal debt limit. And that's got to happen this summer to avoid a catastrophic financial default.
It sounds like a lot riding on this bill, right, Claudia. So what else is in the package?
Right. It extends tax cuts for individuals and businesses as part of a package that was passed under Trump's first term. And there's also a lot of his big campaign promises, like eliminating taxes on tips and overtime pay, but this all comes with a pretty big price tag, more than $4 trillion. So one area they're targeting for savings is cuts to Medicaid. Deficit hawks want to see big reductions there that could lead to millions to lose coverage. That's a big red line for some senators like Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. So a balancing act for Senate Majority Leader John Thune to navigate all these competing demands from his party and President Trump.
Then given those competing demands, how might this bill evolve or maybe even change in the Senate?
Well, I'm told that about 60% or more of this bill is going to stay intact. But when we talk about these bigger pieces of the plan, such as changes to Medicaid, that's likely the largest fight that Senate Republicans will face. And given those concerns, we expect to see resistance to deep cuts to Medicaid from more moderate Senate Republicans. At the same time, if Republicans try to cut back on these reductions, that could upset lawmakers who want bigger spending cuts. So another tough fight could come over repealing tax breaks for clean energy passed by Democrats. As it happens, some Republicans want to look at revising this. And another thing to watch out for is under Senate rules, any provision of this bill that doesn't have a budget impact could have to go.
All right. Tell us about the tea leaves. How can Republicans get this done, or if they can get this done?
Right. It's going to be tough to pass this bill. Republicans are using a special budget rule to avoid a filibuster by Democrats. But that also means that any changes in the bill will need to go back to the House for approval. And getting it through the first time, we saw how brutal that was. So any changes there could mean Republicans could risk another big fight and blowing their deadline.
That's NPR's congressional correspondent, Claudia Grisales. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's bring in somebody who knows the reconciliation process in the Senate, Ron Bongean, former spokesman for Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and former chief of staff to Senator John Kyle, now a partner with ROKK Solutions. Do you just call it Rock Solutions, Ron?
That's right. We just call it Rock Solutions. It's great to be here, Steve. Thank
rock
you.
On, rock on. Good morning.
There you go.
So I'm just thinking 20 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, the conventional wisdom at this point would be that Senate Republicans were a little more, I don't know, broad-minded than House Republicans, by which I mean the House would take an ideological or partisan vote or go for their ideal vote, and then senators would smooth out the edges or just reject their ideas. Is that still the dynamic?
You know what? I'd like to say, yeah, it's still the dynamic usually, but under President Trump, we are under different circumstances. I think that there is much more pressure on these Republicans to act, not only because of the fact that it's the president's signature piece of legislation, but that the debt ceiling needs to be raised by August, or else we default. And that's something that's never happened before. So I think that is an issue. However, I would say that the pressure from Trump is overwhelming, and we've never seen a bill move this fast. This type of size. This is one of the largest bills in American history we've ever had to deal with. I've never seen it move this fast to the House. And I think it's going to move faster through the Senate, despite the Senate concerns.
Oh, that's really interesting, because we are hearing about enough senators objecting to this bill, in theory, to actually reject it. Josh Hawley, Republican, opposed the proposed cuts to Medicaid. He said, if we're going to be a party of the working class, we need to support the working class. Rand Paul, another Republican, is saying, can't deal with this raising the debt ceiling and adding so much debt. Is it really going to be that difficult to...
You know, I would say this. I'd say, you know, on deficit reductions and spending cuts, that's something that the House Freedom Caucus objected to. Because that is such a cerebral argument and one that does affect Americans in the long term, it doesn't affect their immediate issues in the near term. And that's why I think that the argument over Medicaid is really going to be more of the sticking point, where you have Senator Susan Collins and Josh Hawley and Tom Tillis all expressing concerns. Yes, I see the bill slowing down, but I see it eventually passing. Once they can figure this out.
Can I ask about some of the, I was about to say details, but of course these could be tens or hundreds of billions of dollars. They want to get rid of tax breaks for clean energy, for example. And I'm thinking about the way that those tax breaks had been distributed in a way that benefit in some cases red states. You have batteries being made in red states. You have Elon Musk's car company. I mean, there are different ways that people who are on the right benefited. Are provisions like that perhaps likely to go back in to law?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And also on the Medicaid cuts, there are a lot of constituents in red states that could be affected by those too. It's really difficult to say because if you're going to put, you know, $550 billion or some of that of clean energy tax credits back in, you know, back in, you're going to have House Republicans have a real problem with that. Right now, we've got four Senate Republicans that really publicly pose a total repeal of the credits: Lisa Murkowski, Tom Tillis, John Curtis, and Jerry Moran. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all shakes out.
Yeah, and four, we should note, is enough. Since you've got 53 Republicans, four is enough to sink something. Can I ask what you think happened to higher taxes on the rich, given that the president is said to be driving this, it's said to be his agenda, and he said he liked the idea of raising some taxes on the rich, and the House bill didn't include that?
Yeah, I didn't see that as a possibility. That's just something that Republicans, I just don't see them raising the rates on the wealthy. That was something that Trump did propose, and he proposed a new bracket too, and those making $2.5 million or over, I think that's who he considers really rich, would then be hit with a tax cut. But that didn't really fly in the House, and I think it falls countercurrent to what Republicans wanted to see.
One other thing, Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa got in some trouble, or at least was criticized at a town hall meeting when she was told that Medicaid cuts would cause people to die. And she said, well, people are going to die. She then apologized in a way that wasn't really an apology, saying, obviously, people die. She did this in a social media post from a cemetery. Is this helpful to Republicans?
I mean, it is the factually true. We are all going to die.
True.
I don't know if that was the
fact check.
The...
True. Go on.
Right. I don't know if that was the most artful answer given, you know, in a situation like this. But you know, it's hard to explain an answer like that.
Okay. Republican strategist Ron Bongean, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Atlantic hurricane season has started, and forecasters are warning that once again, we could see more storms than average. And experts say people should be prepared even if they live far from the coast. NPR's Shannon Bond reports.
Most storms in the Atlantic form between June 1st and November 30th. And forecasters say this season could be particularly active, in part because of warmer ocean temperatures due to climate change. The National Weather Service predicts as many as 19 named storms, compared with the typical average of 14. Michael Brennan is director of the National Hurricane Center in Miami. He spoke at a press conference a few days ago.
Now is the time for communities all across the United States, all across the Atlantic Basin, East Pacific Basin, to prepare and get ready for what is expected to be a busy hurricane season.
No matter how many storms this season brings, it takes just one hurricane hitting land to cause destruction. Experts say, contrary to what people think, it's the water, not the wind, that is most deadly, even far from the shore.
It doesn't take a hurricane making landfall near you for there to be significant life-threatening hazards and impacts in your community.
Brennan says that's what happened with Hurricane Helene last year, which was the deadliest storm to hit the continental U.S. since Katrina 2 decades ago. Most people who died during Helene were killed by inland flooding in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, hundreds of miles from where Helene made landfall on Florida's panhandle.
It's important to get that message out to inland communities, especially in flood-prone areas, because that freshwater flooding has been such a significant source of fatalities in recent years.
This year's hurricane season is kicking off as the National Weather Service and its parent agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, face staffing shortages and threats of losing funding as the Trump administration makes sweeping cuts to the federal government. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has also lost staff and has said states will have to take on a bigger role in post-disaster relief. Asked about the cuts, Brennan said the National Hurricane Center is ready for the challenges, no matter what the summer brings. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Lucy, I'm home.
Playing Ricky Ricardo on I Love Lucy made Desi Arnaz a star. Behind the scenes, he created what became standard procedures for producing, shooting, lighting, and broadcasting TV sitcoms. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Todd Purdom about his new book, Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Simona Dinerstein has toured the world as a concert pianist, performing in solo recitals and with top-flight orchestras. But in the more than 30 years that she's been performing, a lot of the time she's dreaded getting on stage, even after hours and hours of preparation. And that's because she would experience panic attacks.
I would suddenly lose where I was and get confused. And then it became an anxiety that that would happen.
Her memory lapses became more pronounced on stage after she landed on top of the U.S. Billboard classical chart with a recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations. Dinerstein recently sat down with me at our studios in Washington as she releases her latest album, Complicité.
Sometimes it would be just small things where I could catch myself. Other times it would be really catastrophic, where I would go into the wrong movement or something. It just became this overwhelming anxiety, and all I could focus on as I performed was, would this happen? And it also robbed me of the joy of being in the moment and thinking about the music. It kept me in this straitjacket.
When we were talking about this interview before you came, you sent us a message, and you started it with this phrase: for the last three decades and counting, I have been a performing artist. For much of that period, I also hated performing. If you could just talk about that.
Yes, because performing should be about being open to the possibility of a transcendent experience. There's so much preparation, so much practicing. As a classical pianist in particular, we practice about 6 or 7 hours a day.
Wow.
Yeah. And then in performance, you let go of all of that, and you feel like you're discovering the music for the first time. And I was robbing myself of that, because all I could think about was, am I going to mess up in this very high-pressure situation? And it became absolutely miserable, got worse and worse, and culminated in a concert where it just went so badly that afterwards I was talking to my husband about it, and he was like, you know, you should just quit. And I thought, yeah, I should just quit. All of this was tied to this very conservative notion and convention that we have in classical music, that pianists should play without the music.
From memory.
From memory.
No sheet music.
No sheet music. For some people, that's great. They play better without the music. But I realized that either I was going to have to quit, or I was going to have to perform with the music.
So are you doing that now?
Right. So I am. So the iPad saved my artistic life. Because you can read the music, and there's a Bluetooth pedal, which you can use with your foot to turn the pages. And so you don't need a person sitting next to you turning pages, because pianists have so many notes. Our scores are often like 100 pages long, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, we have that much in our head.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I still memorize all of my music, but having the music in front of me is just enormously freeing and comforting for me. And the first time that I actually performed with an iPad was when Philip Glass composed a piano concerto for me. Mm-hmm. And I decided to play it from the iPad. I learned how to use the pedal, and it was really amazing.
I want to speak a little bit about your new album. It's an all Bach music
yes.
album. Tell me a little bit about the approach here
yes.
that you took and how it's different than what we've heard from you before.
Well, Baroqueland's actually my group that I created when I started using the iPad,
okay.
which I think is not a coincidence. You know, yeah. I started feeling much more creative and free. And it's 11 people in this ensemble, and they're all chamber music players. So they all come from string quartets or other groups. And so I'm like the director, as mm-hmm. in a play, I'm directing it. And with Bach, there's quite a lot of in his music that is very open to very personal interpretation. So we've taken music and rearranged it, thought about, you know, maybe the oboe could play something here, and then we'll have the violin take two parts and do that. Or, you know, on this album, we do a cantata, and there's a beautiful movement where I had the strings divided up so that they took turns one at a time playing. Instead of playing together in unison, we hear one person play, then we hear another person play, mm-hmm. and it goes around a semicircle, and you hear everybody's individuality, their individual sound as it gets passed around.
Yeah.
I really wanted to hear every line in the music and for everybody to have been sort of equally important in this. It's very interactive between the different people. So I called the album Complicité because it comes from a theater term which is about togetherness. It comes from this whole notion of being more connected and as an ensemble. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that idea.
That's pianist Simona Dinnerstein. Her new album is Complicité. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
People in Asheville, North Carolina are still picking up the pieces after Hurricane Helene ripped through last year, damaging or destroying more than 100,000 homes.
There are a lot of people living in their cars. There's a lot of people about to be evicted, and we can't build enough affordable housing fast enough.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, responding to a housing crisis with another hurricane season now underway on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Ukraine carried out a series of drone strikes that hit military bases in the Russian heartland on Sunday. NPR's Charles Maines reports the operation appeared timed to influence the latest round of peace negotiations that took place in Istanbul today.
The idea here is the two sides will discuss proposals outlining their visions for a peace accord. Russia has gone into these talks presenting itself as the one dictating the terms because it's in the stronger position militarily. President Trump has essentially agreed with that Russian position and argued Ukraine needs to make major concessions. You know, think back to that moment in the White House earlier this year when Trump told Zelensky Ukraine had no cards to play. Well, that narrative was somewhat upended by events on Sunday.
That's NPR's Charles Maines. The investigation continues into an attack during a peace march in Boulder, Colorado on Sunday. Authorities say a man used a homemade flamethrower and Molotov cocktail to target protesters calling for the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza. State Attorney General Phil Weiser says 8 people were injured.
The burns that were suffered from people on the scene are going to leave, in some cases, as much of a psychological scar as physical harm.
Officials say the suspect, who was arrested, had overstayed a U.S. visa. This is NPR. Ballots are still being counted in Mexico following the nation's first-ever judicial elections held on Sunday. Citizens were allowed to vote for more than 2,500 judges and magistrates, including all 9 Supreme Court justices. Despite the historic nature of the elections, officials say voter turnout was low. The Drama Desk Awards were handed out in New York City this weekend. While the awards make no distinction between Broadway and off-Broadway in the nominations, Jeff London reports the winners are often predictors of the Tonys.
The big winner of the night was the quirky, gentle new Broadway musical about robots falling in love, maybe happy ending. It picked up 6 awards, including Outstanding New Musical.
The world within my room, I choose a book and I read it, a place to...
It's up for 10 Tony Awards. Brandon Jacobs Jenkins' play, Purpose, already a Pulitzer Prize winner, was named Outstanding Play. Eureka Day and Gypsy won in the Outstanding Revival categories. And 2 actors were named for Outstanding Lead Performance in a Musical. Veteran Audra McDonald for Gypsy and newcomer Jasmine Amy Rogers for Boop. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Stocks are trading lower on Wall Street. The Dow was down 225 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Linda Moodbell Learning Center's one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. The Trump administration is making it more difficult for healthy children and healthy pregnant women to get the COVID vaccine. And that is worrying parents, younger adults, and pregnant women who still want the shot. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein spoke with some of them.
Lauren Capetti was relaxing with her husband at their home in Cincinnati when she heard about the new recommendations for who should get a COVID vaccine.
I was sitting on my couch watching the news. I was just like, what is happening? I started crying. I was like, they're not recommending it for pregnant women anymore. And I was like, is this really like what's happening? Like, am I not going to be able to get this vaccine? Why? That's absolutely terrifying.
Terrifying because the 30-year-old Ohio State worker is about 5 months pregnant, but the CDC is no longer recommending the shots for healthy pregnant women.
I don't want to get COVID while I'm pregnant. I don't want it to hurt my child. I don't want to have a premature birth. I just know that there's complications that come along with it, so that does scare me.
She also knows that the only way to protect her newborn baby is by getting vaccinated herself.
Not only does it protect me while I'm pregnant, but it does help the child once they're born in their first few months of life when they have zero immunity to it whatsoever. So, you know, that's important to me. I want my child to have access to that.
And healthy pregnant women aren't the only people who are worried. In Nashville, Ashley Hoskins, her husband Bob, and their daughter want to keep getting vaccinated too. That's because Bob has to take powerful drugs to prevent his body from rejecting his transplanted kidney.
He's at a heightened risk to catch everything. So not only do we have to worry about whether or not he can receive vaccines, we have always had to be vaccinated as well to provide another wall of protection around him.
Bob will still be able to get a shot, but now Hoskins and her daughter worry whether they will too. That's because the FDA now says there's only enough evidence proving the vaccines are safe and effective for people 65 or older or who have other health problems. So Hoskins may no longer qualify. And as for her daughter, the CDC isn't recommending the vaccine for healthy kids anymore, just saying parents can talk to their doctors about getting the shots.
Blanket decisions like this, it doesn't allow the families to think about their own private situation. How do we protect the people that we love? People are going to get hurt. So yeah, it's frustrating. It's scary.
And Rachel Sampler Zelaya is worried too. She's 42 and lives in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. Her 6-year-old daughter has asthma, so she wants to keep getting herself, her husband, and their two other healthy kids vaccinated to protect her, too. But the new policies could make it harder for the rest of the family.
I'm angry. Angry, frustrated.
And she's not just angry and frustrated because she's worried about protecting her daughter. She wants to shield the whole family.
It's not just a cold. It affects the vascular system, the neurological system, the immune system. And even mild cases have the potential to develop into long COVID. You know, the brain fog, the memory, the fatigue. We vaccinate for far less. And this is definitely a disease to me that needs to be vaccinated for.
She says suddenly having to worry about the vaccines again feels like a flashback to the early days of the pandemic.
Feels like we are going back in time again to that same place where there's not a whole lot that I can do to protect my kids.
Federal officials say the changes make sense because so many people have so much immunity now. They also question the safety of the vaccines, even though billions of people have gotten the shots. Many experts say that demonstrates the vaccines are very safe and effective for everyone. Competti, Hoskins, and Zelaya know they will probably still be able to get the shots by paying for them for themselves. But all the uncertainty and changing rules makes them anxious. Here's Competti again, the pregnant woman from Ohio.
Yeah, I'm just worried that if we're losing access to, you know, COVID vaccines, and I don't know if other things are going to get taken away. I'm just scared. I'm just scared. I don't know what's happening.
Rob Stein, NPR News.
President Trump's administration is ending temporary protected status for thousands of immigrants to this country. TPS protected people from more than a dozen countries. Some Afghans have been told they're losing that status, along with 350,000 Venezuelans. For about 50,000 Hondurans, TPS expires on July 5th. Abby Levine from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, has more.
Brijan Funes' parents came to the United States in 1998 after Hurricane Mitch left them homeless in Honduras.
Lots of folks lost access to water, transportation, roads, was all just a disaster.
Funes joined them in 2000. He was 4 years old. Today, he, along with his parents, is one of over 1 million immigrants who depend on temporary protected status to remain in the United States. The program is a humanitarian designation for countries stricken by war, natural disaster, or other catastrophes, giving recipients who live in the United States deportation protection and access to work permits. It's extended in increments of up to a year and a half, and beneficiaries have to routinely reapply to maintain their status. But this state of limbo hasn't kept Funes from forming deep ties.
I'm an immigrant, and I'm a TPS immigrant. You know, I wasn't born on this land, but I want to be buried on it. And so this is home.
He works at a bank, and in his free time, he runs a pickup soccer league in Winston-Salem. It's become an important outlet for immigrants and their friends. Funes says it's important that they know whatever status they have.
There's a community here that cares about them regardless of that. You know, whether you're a citizen or not, you do have rights when you're within the United States.
Within the landmark Immigration Act of 1990, Congress established TPS as a means of obtaining temporary legal status, not as a pathway to citizenship or permanent residency, commonly referred to as a green card.
That's been a terrible oversight by administrations in the past.
That's immigration attorney Helen Parsonage. She's been fielding more calls from TPS holders asking about their options before their status expires.
Because it's a lesser status in terms of durability and reliability. It can be taken away, as we are seeing.
In February, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem terminated TPS for more than 300,000 Venezuelans early, clearing the way for them to lose protection from deportation in April. A lower court tried to block the move, but the Supreme Court ultimately sided with Noem. Meanwhile, the battle over ending TPS early continues to play out in the lower court. Funes will lose his job when his status expires. As a child of migrants, he can apply for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, but immigration authorities aren't processing new applications right now.
So yeah, I don't know. It's a wait and see type of thing, and it is nerve-wracking. I have a cheesy Star Wars quote that I kind of keep top of mind.
Channeling Princess Leia, he says,
"Hope is like the sun. If you only believe in it when you see it, you'll never make it through the night."
He says he clings to that quote in hopes of some kind of solution. For NPR News, I'm Abby Levine in Winston-Salem.
This is NPR News.
After her cousin nearly fell victim to a spiked drink, a college sophomore helps create and market a smart straw to detect drugs. Next time, Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep with news of our ancestors. Ancient humans turned pieces of whale bone into tools for hunting. Scientists thought this began around 5,000 years ago, but new research into bone spears in Spain shows they're 20,000 years old. It would seem we've been making tools at least that long. What I really want them to find, though, is the ancient whalebone Swiss Army knife, can opener, or power drill. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Demand for beef tallow is up, and not just because RFK Jr. wants fast food chains to use it again. It's actually become a trendy skincare product. People who use it say it can clear up acne and that it's great for dry skin. Health reporter Sarah Bowden looks into whether these claims are cow pies or the real deal.
Tallow is rendered animal fat, which sounds gross, though it's been used in cosmetics since at least the Roman Empire. And in 2025, some people are turning back to tallow because they like that it is a simple one-ingredient cosmetic. And it's taken off on social media.
This is whipped beef tallow, which is 100% beef tallow with grass-fed and finished beef tallow.
This is a TikTok from an account called It's Colleen Shop, which earns a commission. She dips her finger into the tallow and takes a lick.
If you can't eat your skincare, then you shouldn't be putting it on your face.
But clinicians say that's not a good rule of thumb. Dr. Delilah Foulad is a dermatologist at UCLA Health. She says moisturizing with tallow can cause problems.
It can make acne worse because of its like high lipid content.
Lipids are fatty compounds, so they clog your pores.
I am worried about patients being allergic to it.
And people with psoriasis or eczema should be extra careful since their skin is already compromised. That's not to say that tallow won't give you some good results. Marissa Plesha is the vice president of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists. She says the lipids in tallow create a sort of barrier that prevents water loss.
Water helps your skin be plump and, you know, all the things that you want your skin to look like, you know, nice and dewy and everything.
Things like shea butter and olive oil can also lock in moisture, but pure fats don't add hydration to your skin.
Beef tallow doesn't directly add water to the skin. It won't like attract water from the atmosphere, or it won't really bind to water.
Lotions that chemists formulate include ingredients that will do this. But we're at a cultural moment where people don't want cosmetics made in a lab.
And that is a backswing to corporate developments of things like food and household products that have often had ingredients that have not been particularly safe or have environmental impacts.
Jennifer Reich is a sociologist at the University of Colorado, Denver. She says American consumers are exhausted in trying to figure out what's safe or what's healthy. So as a sort of shortcut, we select products like beef tallow that seem pure or natural. Of course, natural is hard to define.
Whether it's a natural source, a natural ingredient, is it the natural production process?
Reich says this rejection of modern science can lead to dangerous choices, like drinking unpasteurized milk or trying unproven medical treatments. If you still want to give beef tallow a try, though, Foulad says patients should start with a patch test.
Put it on one area of your skin for a couple weeks. Make sure you don't react before you slather it on, you know, your entire face and body.
Also, maybe keep your tallow in the fridge. It's getting hot out and you don't want it to go rancid. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Poland has elected a new president, Karol Nawrocki, a former historian who won an extremely tight race. Now, this is a little complicated. Poland is one of those countries that has both a president and a prime minister. The prime minister, Donald Tusk, leads a centrist coalition that is focused on restoring democratic institutions and the rule of law. The new president is a right-wing candidate, so what does his election mean? Let's ask Andrzej Babinski, Managing Director of Polityka Insight, a Warsaw-based policy think tank. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you. What power does the new president have?
He runs, he oversees foreign policy and defense and security policy, and he has veto rights. So whatever the government votes on and pushes through the Sejm or the parliament, the president has to sign off on or can veto, thus blocking the government's work.
Oh, interesting. So he's got a lot more power than some presidents do. Now, I'm trying to figure this out from the outside as a layman. I'm aware that the old government from years ago in Poland was criticized for knocking around the free press, for damaging the courts. The newer government, Donald Tusk's government, is trying to fix that. Can the new president stand in the way, and does he want to?
I think he does want to, but I don't think he can stand in the way today and tomorrow. But what he can do is basically pave a way for the party that fielded him, Law and Justice, to get back to government and to get back to the illiberal revolution that we saw between 2015 and 2023.
Okay. What does his election then say about the mood of Poland's electorate and what they want?
Well, it was a very close race. Actually, when we saw the exit polls come in, it seemed as if Rafał Trzaskowski had won it, the Liberal candidate. When the late polls came in, the tide turned and we saw a victory by Karol Nawrocki, who won by just over one percentage point. So, I mean, this is a country that's very, very divided. And I think that basically this was a referendum for against the government. And as is often the case, especially in these times, people voted against the government. But as I said, this was an extremely tight race, and it does spell a lot of trouble for the government. But the question is, what happens now?
What caused people to vote against the government in this case?
I think that basically people were unhappy with the fact that the government hadn't delivered on the reforms it had promised in 2023. There was a huge excitement in 2023 when this government, the ruling coalition, had defeated Law and Justice. And there was this feeling that finally the country had overthrown and beat the right-wing populists. And nothing much happened later. And basically, this was also because of the fact that this was a very broad coalition from the progressive left to the conservative Peasants' Party. And this made it practically impossible to move things along. Also, with a president from the previous regime, Andrzej Duda, who was vetoing and blocking any ideas of reform. So Basically, people were unhappy with the fact that not much has changed. I mean, a lot has changed, but basically the reforms that were promised didn't come about. And I'd name rule of law on the one hand and abortion laws on the other.
Very interesting. One other thing in about 10 seconds here. You said that the president oversees foreign policy. Would he change Poland's great support for Ukraine?
He might. He's very anti-Ukrainian, and I think this was one of the reasons why Karol Nawrocki won. There's a growing anti-Ukrainian sentiment. It's rather about Ukrainian migrants to Poland rather than Ukrainians' foreign policy or the situation of the war, but this will be a problem. And I think what you need to keep in mind and remember, I think Karol Nawrocki brings a sort of MAGA brand of politics to Polish politics, so this is what we're going to be looking out for.
We'll watch for that. Andrzej Babinski in Warsaw, thanks.
Thank you.
The sharing economy comes for us all, including kids. Reporter Buffy Gorilla takes us to Philadelphia in a paid library for toys that hopes to keep playthings out of the landfill.
Bubbling with excitement, Crystal Cuniera watches the Rutabaga toy library door open. Her first Ruta baby, as she calls them, of the day, waddles in.
And our first little visitor. Hey, Augie!
Augie is a Rutabaga regular, and he's here to play. Augie doesn't say much. After washing his hands, everything in the toy library is reassuringly clean. He smiles and throws me and my fuzzy microphone some wary side eye.
Are you going to go down now? Yeah, let's go down.
Kuniera spots Augie as he climbs on a wooden structure with the slide, sitting in the middle of a colorful braided rug. After becoming a mom, Kuniera started to think about ways to live more sustainably. And the biggest roadblock was the toy box.
We had these higher-end toys that I didn't want to just get rid of. So my group of friends, we started sharing toys, and it just felt like there was something more there.
So it's a pretty simple concept.
A toy library is just like a book library, but for toys. You borrow them and you bring them back and exchange them.
But Kuniera runs it like a business. Families pay up to $65 per month, and there are scholarships.
They get to borrow 4 toys at a time with unlimited exchanges, so they literally can come back every single day and exchange one or all of them.
That appeals to members like Kristen Stitt. She loves that she can try before she buys a new toy for her son, Sean.
I can take a toy home, see if he loves it. If he doesn't, I bring it back, and I haven't wasted any money on it.
Rutabaga opened in 2019 with 300 toys, but now the selection is huge.
Now we have 1,800 items in our library for ages 0 to about 12 years old, and families use this as a gathering space, a resource for toys to not clutter their home, and a play space.
Stitt and Sean are huge fans of the toy library.
Mix Mix, are you making dinner?
We come to play here like 3 times a week. We love it. He's built such a little friend community. People know his name. He knows other people's names.
Joe Schottkiss and his son Towns are frequent guests.
The fact that we can bring our kid here multiple times a day for story time or just to play around is pretty incredible. Without this resource, we don't know what we would do with him most of the day.
But for the kids, it's really all about the toys.
Tow truck? Tow truck?
And the Ruta babies will be back for more. For NPR News, I'm Buffy Gorilla in Philadelphia.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.